Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory.
Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Nathan Connolly.
And I'm Brian Ballow.
If you're new to the podcast, we're all historians, along with our colleagues Ed Ayers and Joanne Freeman. And each week, we explore a topic in American history.
Last month, youth climate activist Greta Thunberg gave an impassioned speech at the United Nations Climate Summit. During the speech, she admonished world leaders for their unwillingness to take meaningful action against climate change.
You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
But this is hardly the first time the world has faced the prospect of mass extinction. In the beginning of the 20th century, America's flora and fauna were seriously threatened by urban encroachment and overhunting. And one animal at the center of this struggle was the bison.
By the end of the 19th century, once various environmental factors and human hunters had done their work, there were fewer than 1,000 bison left in North America.
That's Andrew Eisenberg. He specializes in environmental history and has studied how the bison went from an animal in excess to near extinction in the 19th century. He says at one point, in the early 1800s, there were tens of millions of bison roaming America's Great Plains.
Some years it may have been above 30 million, and then they may have overgrazed the range, and then the number would crash. The number of bison is always fluctuating and going up and down. That 30 million or 24 or 25 million is probably much closer to the maximum number that the Great Plains could sustain.
So how did an animal which grazed the western grasslands in its millions reach the brink of extinction in under 100 years? And what's the current state of the bison? Today, you can find bison protected on animal preserves in the West and packaged for consumption on the shelves of grocery stores. And in 2016, President Obama named the bison America's first national mammal. So what exactly does the animal represent to people? And how has the bison population changed with the times?
In celebration of World Animal Day, we're going to explore the history of the bison in the United States. We'll hear more from Andrew Eisenberg on what caused the bison's destruction in the 19th century and why some today see it as a symbol of a bygone American frontier.
You'll find out how one man is working to restore buffalo for the Eastern Shoshone tribe at Wind River Reservation in Wyoming.
And you'll learn about the surprising and troubling connection between bison preservation and Adolf Hitler. Let's start our story back in the early 1800s, when millions of bison roamed the Great Plains. And as Andrew Eisenberg says, diverse groups of Native Americans, like the Lakota and Cheyenne tribes, were hunting them.
If you look at the number of natives and you look at the pressure they're putting on the bison, in a good year, the number of bison that they're consuming for food and for hides, for their lodges and for robes to keep themselves warm — the robe is the winter skin of the bison with the hair still attached — all of that was well within the capacity of the bison to sustain.
But in the 1860s, everything changed with the influx of white hunters in the Great Plains. In a short amount of time, Eisenberg says, these hunters delivered a devastating blow to the bison population.
What happens in the 1860s, and really after the Civil War, it's a kind of spasm of industrial expansion on the part of the United States as the U.S. lurches into the Great Plains. So there are very powerful, accurate rifles that have been developed during the Civil War. In the late 1860s, railroads start reaching out into the Great Plains. So all of these things kind of conspired to have a few thousand white hide hunters move first into the southern Great Plains, and then they move farther north. And they delivered the coup de grace to the bison, that native hunting had chipped away at the bison population over several decades. Within about 10 or 15 years, these white hide hunters did away with about 12 to 15 million bison. And though we don't necessarily think about this now, tanning and leather was, I think, the fifth largest industry in the United States in the middle of the 19th century or end of the 19th century. And there's an extraordinary demand for this. And so bison leather was simply just incorporated into this expanding demand. And as it turned out, bison leather is highly elastic. So a lot of it wound up as belting for industrial machinery, which is another sense in which this is a kind of industrial consumption of the bison.
Now, there has been speculation that the federal government actively supported the destruction of the bison by white hunters. Is that the case?
Yes. I think we have to phrase this very carefully. Some people have said that the army went out and shot bison in order to deny their use to Indians so that natives would have to submit to the reservation system. And in fact, what did happen is that there were too few bison left for natives to sustain themselves, and they had to submit to the reservation system. And the army welcomed this because the army was not having a lot of success when they were fighting natives directly. They were beaten rather badly a couple times in 1876 by the Lakota and Cheyenne and Arapaho. But what's not true is that the army went out and did this directly. In fact, what happened was it was private hunters who did the work of killing off the bison. The army and the Department of the Interior saw what was happening and applauded what was happening, but they didn't direct it. So the way I put it is that the federal government commended the work of these hunters, but it didn't command them.
Right. It probably could have put a stop to it, but
it absolutely could have put a stop to it. There were a couple of bills that were introduced into Congress in the 1870s that would have forbade the hunting of bison in federal territories. And the people who were sponsoring this legislation were inspired by the SPCA, the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which was founded right after the Civil War and primarily had as its mission kind treatment of pets and domestic livestock. And this was the SPCA's first and perhaps maybe their only effort to extend their mission to a wild animal. And the people who were in favor of this legislation in Congress, I remember reading in the debates in Congress, what one of them said is that a man who will kill a bison is someone who would shoot down his mother's cow in the barnyard. So really sort of adopting that SPCA rhetoric.
Yes. There are those who've critiqued your interpretation of the decline of bison for placing too much blame on Native Americans. I wanted to get your response to that.
Well, I don't think that anyone who's read the book Destruction of the Bison with an open mind would think that I let white hide hunters off the hook. I make it very clear that they were the ones who delivered the coup de grace to the bison. And I think it's one thing to say that Native groups who had kind of improvised a new resource strategy around hunting bison from horseback. And over the course of 80 years or so, from, you know, beginning around the 1770s and 1780s, chipped away at the bison population in concert with environmental factors over which they had no control, like the fact that the weather began to get warmer in the Great Plains starting in the 1850s, and that those patchy droughts throughout the Great Plains were kind of chipping away at the bison population as well. To me, that kind of use of the bison, where they may have been overusing the bison in seasons when there was not enough rainfall to support the bison population, is very different from this industrial surge into the Great Plains in the 1860s and 1870s that did away with 12 or 15 million bison very quickly. For instance, we don't know whether natives left to themselves might not have reconfigured their use of the bison, you know, having realized that, in some seasons we may be killing more than can be sustained, we need to pull back on this. We don't know because they weren't given the chance to figure that out. So to me, they're very different things.
You know, often we don't miss something until it's gone or disappearing. Was that the case with the precipitous decline of the bison? What I'm getting at here, Andrew, is trying to understand the move to preserve the bison.
Yeah, there's a very interesting pivot or slalom on the part of a lot of white Americans about the bison. It was a species that was thought of as wild, as the resource of the natives, as an animal that would interfere with farming and ranching in the Great Plains. And so a lot of people applauded the destruction of the bison in the 1870s.
So they were seen as pests.
Yeah, there was a way of opening up the Great Plains. And then as soon as natives were on reservations and no longer presented the same threat to white settlement of the West, then there were a number of people who became very nostalgic about the bison and sought to preserve it from extinction. And these people included Teddy Roosevelt, who was, you know, very much about a kind of frontier masculine notion of the West and how that sort of experience of the West was good for all Americans. William Hornaday, who ran the Bronx Zoo, also some pretty prominent people, J.P. Morgan among them. All of them got together and founded the American Bison Society in 1905. And the idea was to preserve the bison from extinction. And what they did was they rounded up the bison and they collected a few, really fewer than 100, and they put them on some very small preserves. And they installed these bison on those preserves and then declared that they had done their job, because what they essentially created them as tourist attractions. People could go see bison, experience the West, and then return to cities or return to the East having tasted the flavor of the frontier.
What do you make of turning the bison into a symbol of Western masculinity when clearly that Western masculinity had almost led the bison to become extinct?
Right. Well, there's obviously a lot of irony to that. I think that one of the things we need to think about is that, you know, this kind of preservation happened within the cultural context of the late 19th and early 20th century. And elites such as Teddy Roosevelt had an overweening concern with what they saw as the sort of debilitating and feminizing effects of citified, cosmopolitan, easy living. And so they really were advocating this kind of move to get back into the outdoors and experience kind of strenuous living in the West, the kind of living that bison hunters had, they imagined, in the 1870s and 1880s. And so going to national parks or going to a bison preserve and at least seeing these kinds of animals, even if you weren't hunting them, although there was continued hunting of bison going on at private ranches, that would give you this kind of taste of the frontier. The bison were preserved in a peculiar kind of way. They no longer had free range throughout the West. They were preserved in very small little herds. And those herds were so small, in fact, that there was not enough genetic diversity. And so there are some genetic anomalies that began to occur after a few generations of these small herds on these tourist preserves. And that's not something that the American Bison Society necessarily understood. In fact, to the contrary, they thought that these few bison that had survived the slaughter of the 19th century must be the fittest of the species, so it'd be okay to start over with them in these preserves.
So how many bison are there today?
Well, there's somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million bison in the United States, and the overwhelming majority of them are on ranches, and they are raised for slaughter. There are only about 10 or 15,000 bison on public preserves. And that gets to the weird status of bison in the United States, that they are animals you can go see at a zoo or in a public preserve, and you can also go to a supermarket and buy a bison steak. And that's a kind of strange position to be in. You know, what I find interesting about that is that we get upset about the Yellowstone bison being killed because we've kind of thought of the bison as, though it wasn't when this began our national mammal, but it always sort of unofficially was a kind of symbol of something. But we don't get upset at all at the large number of bison that are slaughtered every day in abattoirs in order to provide meat for restaurants and supermarkets. So they're biologically exactly the same animal, but one of them on a public preserve we've decided is special, and the other one on a private ranch we don't think is special.
Andrew Eisenberg is the Hall Distinguished Professor of American History at the University of Kansas. He's also the author of the book, The Destruction of the Bison, An Environmental History, 1750 through 1920.
Madison Grant is one of the more important figures in American history you've probably never heard of. Credited as the savior to some of our most cherished wildlife, Grant was one of the original founders of the conservation movement.
But beneath his pioneering theories on conservation lay a dark undercurrent of scientific racism. While Grant devoted his life to preserving bison and other endangered species, he also worked tirelessly to save what he considered the superior human race, blonde-haired, blue-eyed Nordics. Born in 1865 to a wealthy family in Manhattan, Grant spent much of his early adulthood going to elite men's clubs and hunting big game.
He's the same class as Teddy Roosevelt, and drinking and hunting were what men like that who didn't have to worry about earning a living did.
Well, some things never change.
Indeed.
That's historian Jonathan Spiro. He says while young Grant was a prolific hunter, he soon underwent a dramatic transformation.
The more that Grant hunted, the more he noticed that our wildlife population was declining because of unrestricted hunting and because of the encroachments of urban civilization. And to his credit, he was transformed from a rather shallow young man known for his carousing and his hunting into an ardent conservationist. So by the 1890s, he would have looked at the bison and realized starkly and to his horror that they were declining precipitously in population. And so he concluded that we need to save the bison, and not save the bison so I can hunt them 20 years from now. Save the bison because they have a right to exist.
As the bison teetered on the verge of extinction, Grant came up with a plan. He started by lobbying to create a bison refuge in their former habitat.
In fact, he actually hoped to create 4 bison refuges, purposefully separated to ensure that no one calamity or disease
right.
would endanger the entire species. So he surveyed all the national forests and hit upon one. It's called Wichita Mountains National Forest. It's in Oklahoma, which had great grazing grounds for the southern herd of American bison originally. And in 1905, Grant convinced his friend Teddy Roosevelt, who happened to be president of the United States, to create the Wichita Mountains National Wildlife Refuge in Oklahoma. It's the nation's first ever big game refuge. And William T. Hornaday, the director of the Bronx Zoo, then selected 15 bison from the zoo's herd. He drove them to Grand Central Station.
He didn't take a cab, did he?
He did not take a cab. There's photos of the wagons in which he drove them down to the railroad station.
Because, you know, it's hard enough to get a cab in Manhattan, but, you know, hailing a cab with a herd of bison, that's a tough call.
He gets these bison onto a train, and they head out west, and it really was a spectacle. Throngs of Westerners would come out along the railroad route to see these bison. Aged Native Americans showed up to see a living bison, and they would applaud as the train drove out west. It took them a week. They arrived in Oklahoma. They were released into their new home. And to make a long and happy story short, those 15 bison from the Bronx have now grown into a very happy, safe, and prolific herd of 1,000 bison.
Were there kind of moving in issues? I mean, when you go from the Bronx, I would have trouble going from the Bronx to Oklahoma. Did the bison struggle, or did they like feel right at home right away?
There were all kinds of issues, issues with ticks, issues with predators, issues with poachers. These were all issues that Grant and his fellow conservationists had to work out. In fact, it became such a project that Grant decided to create an organization, the American Bison Society, specifically to help the bison acclimate to the new range and to create, remember, he wanted to create four refuges. So he felt they needed an organization to raise the money to create the three more refuges that they needed. William Hornaday was the first president of the American Bison Society. Teddy Roosevelt was the honorary president. And they gave lectures, they wrote newspaper and magazine articles extolling the cause of bison preservation. The American Bison Society had a very dramatic logo in which painter Maxfield Parrish had this magnificent bull standing proudly on a rocky mound. And as a result, the public became actually very aware of the plight of the bison. Donations pour into the Bison Society. The Society reconnoiters possible additional ranges out west. They identify three more possible ranges, and they lobby Congress. Madison, Grant, Hornaday lobby Congress. And by the time of the First World War, Congress, in fact, had established three more bison ranges, one in Montana, one in South Dakota, one in Nebraska. And those are the first four bison refuges. They are national treasures.
And by now, there were enough bison to actually populate them.
Well, they were still being populated by bison from either zoos or private collections. And Madison Grant insisted on absolutely pure-blooded bison. And most bison that you would just find in the wild had by now mated with cows. They were called cattalos. And he didn't want to save that species. He wanted actual bison. But that's how they saved the bison. There were 500 bison left when he started, and today there's 500,000 bison. It's one of the great conservation efforts in world history.
It's a remarkable story. But there was a phrase that you used, his fascination with pure-blooded, that I want to return to because he felt that way about human beings as well. Am I wrong?
In 1916, Madison Grant published The Passing of the Great Race. And it's one of the most influential books of the 20th century because it employed the latest findings of science to claim that the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Nordics, that's a term invented by Madison Grant, the Nordics are the master race. But of course, the book is entitled The Passing of the Great Race.
Right.
And that's because Grant claims that the Nordics are becoming extinct. The great race is passing. How could the master race be dying out? Because in 1916, the Nordics in America are being swamped by millions of inferior immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe who were predominantly Catholic and, worst of all, as far as Madison Grant is concerned, Jews.
Right. My relatives.
And my relatives. And Grant felt he must warn his fellow Nordics that we must prevent these inferior immigrants from polluting our pure blood, or the great race is going to pass.
And Jonathan, did he draw upon his understanding of the principles of conservation and saving the bison in order to come to this conclusion about humans?
Absolutely. Grant learned from his work in conservation that, first of all, one of the worst things you can do is introduce non-native species into North America because they'll take over and drive out the native-born species.
Wow.
You can see that Jews, in his mind, are like weeds being introduced in North America, and they're going to drive out the native Nordics.
You know, as historians, we're not supposed to jump ahead, but, you know, I got to ask you whether a guy like Hitler picked up on this kind of thinking.
Sadly and tragically, yes. In 1924, Hitler read a German translation of The Passing of the Great Race, Der Untergang der großen Rasse, and learned from this respected American conservationist that the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Nordics, which in Germany they call Aryans, are the master race, and that the dark-haired, dark-eyed Jews are the lowest of the races. And Hitler declared Madison Grant's Passing of the Great Race is my Bible. Not surprisingly, therefore, most of the leaders of the Nazi Party read it. And at the Nuremberg war crimes trials after World War II, when the U.S. put the surviving leaders of the Third Reich on trial, the Nazi defendants entered the Passing of the Great Race as a defense exhibit to justify their policy of anti-Semitic genocide.
So how do you square, let's call it the overlap, between some conservationist thought and eugenic thought?
Well, we're speaking in 2019, where, to be blunt, conservationism good, racism bad. That, of course, is not how they viewed these things back at the turn of the 20th century. Madison Grant was hardly the only conservationist who was a racist in those days. Indeed, with some notable exceptions, John Muir comes to mind, most of Grant's peers were active in both the conservation movement and the eugenic movement, which was the movement to implement scientific racism. And I am an historian. I can attempt to put myself in the shoes of historical actors, and I can empathize with the fact that the members of the Eastern aristocracy in 1900 were deeply anxious that they were losing their hold over America. And their reactionary response was to desperately try to preserve the best and largest and oldest and most magnificent of our endangered native species. In the case of fauna, that means save the American bison. Flora, the gigantic redwoods. People, the superior Nordics. It was clear to Grant, at least, that just as the noble bison were going extinct, so too were the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Nordics, and it was his duty to save them.
Jonathan Spiro is Dean of the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at Castleton University. He's also the author of Defending the Master Race: Conservation, Eugenics, and the Legacy of Madison Grant.
When we witnessed the wildebeest migration, there was something that clicked.
This is Jason Baldus talking about a pivotal moment for him in the late 1990s. He was in East Africa, the Serengeti and Maasai Mara plains, and he was witnessing an extraordinary scene, wildebeest, migrating in a herd so massive it defied the imagination.
I was driving for 80 to 100 miles and on dirt roads. And as far as you can see in every direction is wildebeest. And we counted 30 other species or so. One day we saw 88 hyenas. It was at that moment, you know, sitting there with my dad on the plains and having a conversation about what our own Serengeti had looked like. And the realization that what we were seeing was just less than 5% of what the bison was here less than 200 years ago. And so that sparked something in me.
Jason is the buffalo representative for the Eastern Shoshone tribe at the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. He's passionate about bringing bison back to the area where they once roamed.
The hope is that we can instill a respect for this animal. We can work on a paradigm shift of how we view these animals. You know, the story of buffalo and Native Americans is very similar in that We're now on remnants of our once former vast territories. And tribes are now on reservations and buffalo in parks and refuges or on private lands. So you still can't go to anywhere public lands or and very few tribal lands to see bison manage as wildlife. And there's really a discrepancy in how these animals are treated because there's 850,000 or so bison in the commercial meat market. Those are genetically manipulated, but there's only 21,000 bison that exist in conservation populations, meaning they exist as wildlife or under natural regulating factors. So it's important that in bison conservation, we're leading the way towards a paradigm shift that respects these animals as wildlife. We see them all over as logos and emblems and things like that. They're on our flags, but where do you have to go to see them?
I spoke recently with Jason about what it means to restore and reclaim an animal the Eastern Shoshone consider sacred. I started, though, by asking him to take us back to the 1880s, when a local missionary recorded a staggering change.
That particular set of data is from the Shoshone Episcopal missionary by the name of Reverend Roberts, who spent 66 years with the Eastern Shoshone and the Northern Arapaho people. He kept journals documenting the number of bison that were being taken by the tribes at that time. Mm-hmm. And so in 1881, I believe the figure was around 2,500 bison were taken for food, for clothing, shelter, etc. But by 1885, there were 10 that were taken by the tribes. And after that, there were no more available.
All this changed in 2016. That year, building off the work of his father, Jason helped usher in the arrival of 10 bison at Wind River. It was a historic moment.
The tribe had never had access to bison for food or for ceremonial purposes. And so when that first hoof hit the ground in the middle of the night off of that trailer, that's really when it hit home that they were back for us. Not bison to be managed like cows, not bison that get rounded up and ear tagged and vaccinated and treated like a cow. We wanted these buffalo to be respected in the way that they should be, and that is like the other wildlife species. So this effort is unique in that these buffalo will ultimately be treated differently, and it's part of that paradigm shift to show what can happen in terms of what buffalo management as wildlife on tribal lands and how that really can trickle over into how we see them on public lands.
Tell me a little bit more about what seeing the bison as tribal animals, as, you know, part of the community of the Wind River Reservation. What does that mean for the folks living on that reservation and thinking about their own visions of self-determination?
The name for ourselves is Gwich'indika, the Shoshone people here of the Eastern Shoshone Band. We call ourselves the Buffalo Eaters. But again, that buffalo has been gone from us for so long that we've forgotten how to live with that animal. Hmm. We maintain our ceremonies and those types of things, but, you know, even those, it's only really legally been able to practice those ceremonies since the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978. That's 40 years ago. And so we are still healing from some of these policies and things in the past that have resulted in a lot of this intergenerational trauma that we have in our society, in our culture. And so we have to instill a sense of pride, and a way to do that has always been through this buffalo. This buffalo is a way to help us heal. It's a way to help us reconnect. And that's exactly what we're trying to do through an education program, to harvest a buffalo and bring our elders together with our young people to reinvigorate our languages, to learn how we use those parts of that animal, how we process that hide, and even how we utilize those parts in parts of our ceremonies. That these things and cultural revitalization is critical to who we are as Shoshone people, mm-hmm. or Arapaho people, or Blackfeet, or Cheyenne.
And that means that there must be something special about having bison among the folks living at Wind River as opposed to those who are simply on farms or simply being raised for meat? I mean, how would you describe the importance of that difference? I mean, again, you mentioned earlier, it's not about ending necessarily the farm raising of bison, but there is something different about how the Shoshone people are relating to bison.
That is part of that healing process. We did harvest two of our buffalo a couple weeks ago, and it was for those purposes that I mentioned. It was to send meat to the Shoshone reunion that happened about a week ago in Lawton, Oklahoma. Feeding our people buffalo is probably one of the most important steps to relearning how to use it. It was difficult to harvest those animals because of the hard work that it's taken to get them here. Mm. But it's also community education. A lot of our own people don't understand the history of what's happened to bison, the governmental policies that resulted in their extermination, the contemporary efforts, why that's important. But we're also not saying that anybody has to change their livelihood. A lot of people, especially in the cattle industry, feel threatened by bison. And we have tribal farmers and ranchers that run cattle. One of the things we've always said is that these buffalo are in no way a threat to those cattle or that livelihood. That cow benefits that family or that individual. But these buffalo, they benefit everybody.
And for you, it really does begin with thinking about the bison as wildlife.
We currently manage 6 of the 7 ungulate species as wildlife, including the wolves and bears and other predators. Mm-hmm. So why is it that bison or buffalo is the only one that we don't treat like that? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it goes back to the conquering of the West, the notion of manifest destiny, that the pioneers and settlers out here were on a task to remove Indians and remove buffalo. That made way for these large beef operations, many of which are in existence today.
Right.
And so we're now in an era of a time when tribes can exercise some sovereignty. We can relearn our languages. We can practice and be who we are as Shoshones or Arapahos or Lakotas in a time like we've never been able to before.
Right. The herd at Wind River is now to just over 30 bison. Is there a long-term plan for growing the number of bison? Is it about introducing more populations, simply natural reproduction? And what's the idea, or the hope at least, for how many bison the reservation can actually sustain?
The steps that need to take place are of collaboration and more partnership. We have two tribal governments on this reservation, the Eastern Shoshone and the Northern Arapaho. We're both nations are buffalo people. If we can look at buffalo as a benefit to all of us on this reservation, then that means expanding the range into tribal land. We want to reach a threshold of 1,000 animals, and this is for the conservation of the species. The International Union of Conservation of Nature, IUCN, puts out a benchmark of 1,000 animals for you to maintain genetic heterogeneity. We would hope that we could expand range to an area that would facilitate the growth of our population to a harvestable level. Mm-hmm. And then in a period of time, think about expanding further past that. This Wind River Reservation has more potential habitat for bison than almost any other reservation in the West.
Wow.
But again, wildlife management is a lot less about managing wildlife as it is about managing people. Because if you put the animals back in their habitat, they do just fine. It's the people that you have to worry about.
and is this a partisan issue at all, or is this really a matter of what one other activist I spoke to, Nick Estes, described as settler infighting? In other words, that there are folks who are operating in mainstream party politics who are basically wrangling with each other over allocations and apportionments and such, and it has less to do with necessarily what the tribe is trying to put forward.
That's correct. Just a couple of years ago in Montana, we defeated 13 anti-bison bills. And this last legislative session, at least 6 anti-bison bills. There's less of that legislation in Wyoming, but there is that infighting to fight those tribes on getting bison back on the landscape as wildlife, and not even the tribes. You look at the American Prairie Reserve and the CMR, the Charles M. Russell, efforts to restore bison on large landscapes, and they're met with quite a bit of hostility. People don't want to see it.
So, Jason, give me some sense of what the flavor is of these bills that are opposing the expansion of the bison population.
Expanding the bison population has been controversial because, well, you have a population of bison in Yellowstone that in 1902 there was 23. That park grew up essentially around those animals, and the population grew. And it kind of came to a head in 1997 where there was a tough winter. Bison were leaving the park in order to seek winter forage. Of course, inside the park, bison are iconic species that are just revered. But as those animals stepped outside of that imaginary boundary, they became essentially livestock or a threat to the livestock industry because of the perceived threat of brucellosis. Brucellosis was brought by cattle in the first place and infected the wildlife. And then states like Idaho and Montana and Wyoming established brucellosis-free status so that they could export their beef. Mm. Well, that created controversy when those bison went to leave the park. They were shot. There's never been a documented case of a bison giving a cow brucellosis.
Right.
In the wild, there is documented cases of elk giving cattle brucellosis, but elk can move freely across that boundary.
Right.
What is the reasoning there? Well, it's money. The Jackson elk herd, the sports industry that draws in people to hunt elk, is a tremendous economic boost to that economy. If elk were persecuted or treated in the similar way that bison were, that economy could crash or collapse. They don't receive the same economic benefit from bison.
In 2016, President Barack Obama designated the bison the official mammal of the United States. The story of the bison is a big part of American history, obviously, and you lay that history out extraordinarily well and compellingly. But what do we miss if we overlook that centrality, if we don't give the bison their due?
You know, I think back a lot about when our reservation was established. In 1863, the Shoshone Reservation was 44 million acres. That was the traditional territory of the Shoshone people, and this was before the states were, but it would have been half of Wyoming, northern Colorado, northern Utah, and eastern Idaho, and majority of Yellowstone. Only 5 years later, in 1868, our reservation was reduced by 42 million acres.
Wow.
So when it comes to federal Indian law and policy, most Americans look at it like, here's the United States that gave these tribes their reservations.
Right.
When in fact it's the other way around. The tribes relinquished parts of the United States in that we would be able to reserve our reservation, reserve our ways of life in perpetuity. Of course, that didn't happen. Things like the General Allotment Act opened up reservations for homesteading. Then the boarding schools that removed our children. Our spirituality was outlawed. And all of these things chipped away at who we were as Native Americans. Now, I think back to what if our reservation was still 44 million acres?
Mm.
Would we have issues with wildland-urban interface? No, we wouldn't.
Right.
Would we have issues with healthy rivers and streams? Overgrazing by livestock. I think about a lot of these things in that we continue to encroach upon these places that our ancestors had set aside for our continued use and occupancy. And those things are even today being diminished. And that's not for just Native Americans. That's all people, because even our public lands have the potential to be auctioned off. So our democracy is being eroded away. Our access to these public lands, these places, are under threat. And those animals, those birds, those fish, they don't have a voice We have to be that voice for them. And if we can't see it that way, if we're always at the top of the food chain and don't care mm-hmm. about what happens below us, we're in doom. Right. And so I think that we not only need a paradigm shift in terms of how we think about buffalo, but we need a paradigm shift in about how we think about our connection with the natural world.
Jason Baldus is the Eastern Shoshone Tribe's buffalo representative. He also works for the National Wildlife Federation's Tribal Partnerships Program as the Tribal Bison Coordinator.
That's going to do it for us today, but you can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought about the episode or ask us your questions about history. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.